Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week you'll hear about the Central Works production of Edward King, written and directed by Gary Graves, a new comedy about finding your roots. Gary joins me in studio along with actor John Patrick Moore. Liz Fain talks about the Liz Fain dance premiere of Known Once, based on stories collected in partnership with 826 Valencia, as well as The Redwoods, a mixed-income residential community for seniors in Mill Valley. Actor Adam Strauss talks about his one-man show, The Mushroom Cure, at The Marsh. And conductor Michael Morgan shares details about the Oakland Symphony's season finale, a concert version of Guys and Dolls, and offers a preview of next season. Stay with us. Liz Fain Dance self-describes as a company whose work expresses the unpredictable course that comprise one's life. The result is highly physical, emotionally charged choreography, often in immersive set and sound environments. Liz founded the company back in 1988 in Boston, moving to San Francisco in 1990, and the company has since premiered some 50 of Liz's creations, one of which, After the Light, we spoke about together back in 2014. Liz, welcome back to Open Air.
Thank you.
Well, you've been creating works that have been based on literature proper for some 6 years or so, but this is your first delving into direct social research. Why did you decide to do that?
I decided because last year we premiered a piece that the composer I've worked with for a long time led the direction for. He decided he wanted to do a piece about personal privacy, overhearing people's conversations in public, what you deem public, what you deem private, how much control you have. And having just found conversations embedded in the score was a revelation to me because it was very powerful and very moving. And I thought, oh, you know, I don't want someone's story distilled through a writer's eye. I want to try to go right to that story. And so I decided I wanted to work with two population groups at either ends of the spectrum, kids who are in middle school and seniors in their 90s.
Yeah, so sort of a circle of life, so to speak. Hearing stories from the early end of things and then the later end of things.
And asking people about their memories. And what happens to you? What happens? What kinds of things do you remember? What do you cherish over time?
The young people you chose were from 826 Valencia. For folks that aren't familiar with that organization, tell us a little bit about it.
826 Valencia was founded by Dave Eggers. It's an organization devoted to fostering literacy in young people. They have programs where they go into the schools and work with kids, and they also have programs that we were engaged in, teaching workshops to kids. Ours was on the development of text and movement to accompany the text. So we worked with these kids, one group of kids every single week, on developing stories and creating movement for those stories.
That's great. So this has been an ongoing relationship with 826 Valencia that is now proving to be fruitful for one of your own works. That's wonderful.
Yeah, we're excited.
And then on the other end of the spectrum is the group from the Redwoods. Tell us about how you became encountered with them.
I became involved with the Redwoods because we have done performances at the Mill Valley Library that has performance series throughout the year, and the Redwoods always sends people to those performances. So I contacted them when I decided to work with groups of seniors to see if they would be interested. I wanted to work with a mixed-income community, they were very interested. And we ended up with a group of people that were really astonishing.
Surprised you, huh?
Yeah, really, really surprised us. Mm-hmm. We had a man who was a speechwriter for the State Department, a man who was a chemical engineer, a woman who had taught in Saudi Arabia.
Where is the Redwoods?
The Redwoods is in Mill Valley, and it's a senior residence, and the average age is 89. And the people we worked with were all in their 90s.
Wow.
It's kind of shocking.
So how did you come up with this title, Known Once?
I was trying to figure out what to call this, and I thought, oh, Known Once. It's about memory. It's about perception. It's about time and change and how you look at the things that once were front and center in your life, what happens to them as you age, what place do they take in your life.
Interesting. And this creation that is now being presented this weekend at Z-Space is the result of some workshops that happened this past fall. Tell us about the workshops in October and November.
We held intensive workshops simultaneously with at the Redwoods and at 826 Valencia, in which we worked with the seniors and the students on stories about that would evoke memories. What we found immediately with the seniors was that we needed to record their stories, that writing was a little bit more difficult for them.
Mm-hmm.
But as a result, we had hours of video, of audio and videotape of them. And we had them start to move and move to their stories so that we took some of their movements and they became the basis of sections of the dance.
Mm.
With the students at 826 Valencia, we focused more on writing and therefore we have much less of their spoken voice as part of the score. But we did use the stories that they wrote to work with.
Interesting. And did these two groups of people ever meet?
They did not, because the kids at 826 Valencia were there.
Right,
and
right.
It's hard to transport the seniors around.
So is this going to be a literal description of some of these works? How are you integrating your themes of time and change with the stories?
We took three very substantial stories from the seniors, and the piece begins with one, a second one is in the middle, and it ends with a third story. The first story, we start with a fairly literal movement version using the gestures and movements that Charles Carey, the man who told the story, was doing as he was telling the story. We videotaped it, and I'd say, okay, look at this movement and look at that movement, and we'd do that. The rest of the piece developed using more movement that we created using ideas and prompts. I would say things like a movement that reminds you of someone else. So one woman did a movement that her father always does. So it would actually go into their own memories, a movement you would do at the end of time, an opening of a door. So movements that had some relevance to memory, and we would develop ideas in that way. We had a very touching moment with the woman whose story is in the middle of the dance. She came to the last session we had. We had one final session with the seniors about a month ago, and she had had a stroke, and she told us that her husband had to help her get out of bed, and she was fairly frail now. And she said he took her hands in his, and he helped her out of bed one night, and then he put his arms around her, holding her, and danced and sang the Tennessee Waltz. I was so touching.
Mm.
And then he himself had a stroke. So we were very moved, and we said we have to put the Tennessee Waltz in piece. And we had a section of movement following her story, and we said, let's put the Tennessee Waltz here. And it worked. And one of the dancers has a really beautiful voice, and her husband's a musician. So they recorded it.
Oh, nice.
So we feel like it's almost a sense of a family.
How sweet.
And that's what we learned from the seniors, that what they cherish was their personal relations with people. It wasn't their jobs. It wasn't their travels. It wasn't the other stuff.
Mm-hmm. And what is Matthew Antaki contributing to the scenic design to help visualize this?
The design is we wanted to structure the space very architecturally to mirror a sense of time expanding and contracting. So the space is designed to have a wall behind the seats that's lit, so you're very aware of it when you walk in, and a wall near the very front of the stage that mirrors the one behind the seats that's also lit. So you walk in as if you're in a fairly small room. And the first part of the piece takes place in the front of the stage, and then the wall gradually moves back. And then throughout the piece, the wall slowly moves forwards until it's come to the very edge of the space at the very end.
Wow, neat. Neat. Fantastic. And what was the most surprising observation that you got out of your time with the seniors? You mentioned that beautiful story and just their lucidness and their backstories. What was the most surprising thing that came up?
The most surprising thing to me was how much they welcomed talking about their past. I thought they would be more guarded, and they really loved it. They loved having a place where people wanted to hear that. And it was so wonderful for us to be able to receive that.
Mm, very nice. And the same question regarding the 826 Valencia kids. Now, we're talking about middle schoolers, right? Sometimes a difficult age, shall we say, but they're there for a reason.
So. Yes. The middle schoolers were, what was most surprising about them was the things that I would have thought that they would be more aware of, we all realized were so much a part of their lives that they took them for granted, like their parents. Things that when you look back on your parents doing certain things for you, you doing certain things as a family. And you realize, or we did, with these kids that that's just a given for them. And what they think of as important is what's happening right now, every day, and the immediacy of their lives really shone through.
Well, let's just hope they don't watch the news all the time.
Yeah, really?
The challenge for them. Well, distracted minds. Well, we're going to hear a clip to go out with. I believe it's Dan Wool's music, but whose voice will we hear that starts off the clip?
You'll hear the voice of Charles Carey, who's 96 years old and will be coming to the Sunday matinee performance.
Very nice. Liz, thanks for coming in. Once again, Liz Fain presents Known Once. It's going to be at Z-Space Friday through Saturday at 8 p.m., Sunday at 2 p.m. Z-Space is on Florida Street here in San Francisco. More information both at LizFainDance.org and ZSpace.org. Thanks, Liz.
Thank you.
Live together with a family, I see now, pretty easy job for my parents. You know, if we could not fall over or be lost in a storm. And I think it's something that I would miss, and I was never able to give that to my children.
Music of Dan Wool, which will be supplemented, as you heard, by the Tennessee Waltz at one point, combining the stories of the young people from 826 Valencia and the Redwoods, a mixed-income residential community for seniors in Mill Valley, for a theme of time and change. Liz Fain Dance presents Known Once at Z-Space this weekend. Once again, LizFainDance.org or Z-Space. www.lifetogether.org for some more information. Good afternoon once again. I'm David LaTulippe. Still to come, you'll be hearing about the Central Works production of Edward King. Actor Adam Strauss talks about the mushroom cure at the Marsh, and conductor Michael Morgan will share details about the Oakland Symphony's season finale, a concert version of Guys and Dolls. He'll also offer a preview of next season. Well, Central Works' spring production, their 55th world premiere, is Edward King by Gary Graves, a new comedy based on a very old story. The production runs through June 11th at the historic Berkeley City Club. In Edward King, a hardworking couple confronts fate in ways that take some interesting turns and addresses the question, how do you work with something out of your control? The playwright, who is also director, Gary Graves, joined me in studio, as does the title character, Edward King, played by John Patrick Moore. Gary's been a resident playwright and company co-director at Central Works since, 1990 or so, and has been a part of developing all 55 of the world premiere productions with the company, many of which he has either written and or directed. Some of the plays include Project Ahab, Dracula Inquest, Richard I, a trilogy, Chekhov's The Duel, Mata Hari, and Penelope's Odyssey, among others. He also leads the Central Works Writers Workshop and teaches playwriting regularly at the Berkeley Rep School of Theater. Welcome back, Gary.
Great to be here.
Cold and all. We'll be dealing with that. John Patrick Moore is an associate, artistic associate with Central Works, and has directed or acted in over 13 world premieres, including several of the aforementioned works of Gary's, including Project Ahab in 2015, when he and Gary were here to talk about that play. In the Bay Area, John has also worked with the Marin Theater Company, Magic Theater, 42nd Street Moon, Center Rep, Bay Area Playwrights Festival, and SF Playground, among other groups. And welcome back to you, John.
Thank you. Excited to be here.
Sure. Well, let's see. How do we start here? A new comedy, Gary, based on a very old story, as how it was termed. What is the very old story that this comedy, Edward King, is based on?
We thought we'd take the story of Oedipus the King and make it into a comedy.
A laugh a minute.
Yeah.
Natural choice.
Yeah, we started the very first workshop in developing this by reading the Sophocles. And at the end of it, I said to Gary, Gary, this is really sad. He's like, I've got some ideas.
And it's complex.
Oh, yes.
So to speak.
Lots to work with.
But that's not the Oedipus we're going towards here. But there must be more to the story that is giving you some sort of a comedic edge to this rather serious story.
Yeah, our Ed King is a mail carrier for the U.S. Postal Service, has been for over 20 years. He's married to a woman for 21 years, who's works a swing shift at Bob's Big Boy.
I remember Bob's Big Boy.
Yeah, it's okay. Still with us, barely hanging on. They have a daughter that they're putting through college with great sacrifice. They've taken out a second mortgage on the house to try to get the first child in either of their families into college. And they are struggling to get by in their modest San Bernardino home, but there's a problem. There's something growing in the basement. It's crawling up the walls, and it's very mysterious, and it's threatens to actually bring the whole house down because it's getting into the foundation. So Ed determines that he will find out what the source of the problem is and eradicate this blight upon his home, whatever it takes.
Okay. So what parts, where does Oedipus get involved then in this end of things? Or does it enter later in the story?
Well,
John Patrick Moore, enlighten us, please.
Ed has a dream, a very unsettling dream. Well, it starts out pretty good. He's on his mail route. Everything's going great. But then he ends up having an encounter with a masked figure who gives him some information that I don't think he ever really thought he'd hear. And that's where a little of the Oedipus comes in.
Okay. Okay.
He's told that he has married his mother and had a child with her.
Ah, there we go.
In the nightmare. And then he starts trying to put pieces together, and It's like he's standing, you know, on a really high platform, and with each person he encounters, someone pulls a plank out from underneath his feet. It's like the information gets revealed. It's exciting.
So it's a certain degree of anxiety involved in this show, especially with a daughter in college. That the reason that they're working as hard as they are is to keep her in college.
Exactly. It's definitely a play about, you know, all the different kinds of anxiety that can face, you know, a family or a father in particular, and his, obviously his wife, the mother. But what your responsibility is to get your kid through college, to cover the finances, to struggle in an industry that seems to be under a lot of pressure as things are, and getting older and your knees going and your back going and all these other things. So,
and working for the post office on top of all that. And at Bob's Big Boy.
Yeah, or serving burgers at Bob's. You know, it's tough work.
So there's interaction between both dramatic and comedic tensions. Mm-hmm. So the comedy stems from, what is this thing that is ruining my house and my very existence?
Well, he tries a lot of things to, you know, figure out what's happening. He has the dream initially, and then he starts to put the pieces together and realizes that he does have a lot of things about his wife that he doesn't know. So the questions start coming, and with each question, it's like, you know, picking at a thread. Things start to unravel, or it becomes increasingly possible on some level. So,
tell us about your co-star. Your co-star.
Oh yeah, well, I have two amazing co-stars. Jan Zweifler plays the person in the dream, and many of the other people who I go to seek out information. A very unusual psychologist. Very helpful, probably. Not really for Ed, but... And then also his father, who he tracks down, and an exterminator.
That would come into play,
imagine. Yes, exactly. So, yeah, and she's terrific. And then Michelle Talgaro plays my wife, Jo. And we've got some wonderful interactions of... When we finally meet up with each other, when she gets back from the swing shift in the middle of the night, is when most of the time we actually overlap. So it's fun.
I noticed in some of the publicity photos that you're actually wearing a postman's outfit. Yeah. Did you have to get special permission from the Postal Service, or do we not even want to go there?
Yes, we got very special permission.
It was fun, though. We did have our sound designer, Greg Sharpen, had a friend who had worked for the Postal Service for over 20 years and is now retired. But he came in one of our earlier workshops to just talk to us about, you know, we had all these questions for him, and Gary was looking for lingo, and it was really very fun to hear his experience, and also about what was really difficult about it, but also the good pieces too. Mm-hmm. Being out there on your own, mm-hmm. and it's not so. He said it's not so good now because apparently with GPS and everything, they know where you are at every moment.
Well, that's true.
The pressure is even harder.
More
now.
Anxiety, more paranoia added to the production. That's fun. What else will we see on stage other than the three characters? Gary, what have you chosen to show us on the stage?
Well, it's quite a journey. The play begins in this mythic realm of Ed's dreams, and then it goes into the living room of their home, and then we travel down the steps into the basement, into the crawl space underneath the house, and then off to visit a therapist who I think does more harm than good, and then on a journey up into the San Gabriel Mountains to track down his estranged father, whom he's not sure if he is his father, into an old shack up in the mountains where, as a recluse, Morty has been writing away at his 12-volume manifesto for many years. And so he becomes a rather unreliable witness about the past. Mm. And we also visit with Edwina, the exterminator, who suspects she's actually dated Ed at one point in the past. She thinks they went out to screwballs together on singles night, but he has no recollection of that whatsoever.
I've had nights like that. That's certainly understatement. So you've got a perfect setting for staging this, the beautiful hall at the Berkeley City Club. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that Julia Morgan design, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's the little castle with... in comparison to the big one at San Simeon.
Mm-hmm. And do you finding that space works well for helping you paint the picture?
Well, with us, we've been there since 2002, I think, and since we do all new plays, often, not always, but often, we start with the space. We start with the limitations that the space has, and we try to incorporate those into the conception of the play and use the architecture of the building as the setting for the play, so that we try to put the audience in between the actors and the set. And what you get is an extremely intimate experience of theater in which you're only at times a couple of inches away from the actor. John goes and sits among the audience at one point as he takes a break on his route about the neighborhood. And we try to incorporate the windows and the fireplace and the doors
of
the
building. It seems ideal, yeah.
So it's site-specific in that sense.
Indeed. Talking with Gary Graves, writer and director of Edward King and the title character, John Patrick Moore, at the City Club through June 11th as part of Central Works' 55th world premiere. So Ed King has to deal with several crises, shall we say, and that are a lot of it beyond his control. So how exactly does he work things out?
Well, I think he seems really he's really motivated to try to get answers. I think I say I've got to know or I've got to find out over and over again. And it's really interesting to think about someone who has not really explored his past for, I would say, almost 20 years. And this dream sort of triggers all the, you know, a desire to find out all these things. I think, you know, who his parents were, where he came from, what actually is his story, and how does that connect with his family and his life and his world. And once he finally actually starts to look at it, it becomes very scary or threatening or unpredictable. And no one can actually give him any definitive answers, which seems to just really add to the anxiety.
No kidding. Yeah,
there is no solution. And I think he really does consider himself a man of action. I mean, he is prepared to get rid of the mold himself and has his own special mold-killing concoction.
It seems to be tying in some things that not only mold removal, but Americans seem to be attracted to trying to find out who they are and where they came from.
Exactly. So it's the eternal question, where did I come from?
And how do I get rid of this mold?
Well, he begins to wonder why the mold is down there. And is there some reason beyond mere coincidence?
Are their bodies buried, so to speak, in some metaphorical way, perhaps?
You know, what's happening with their daughter, you know, in her first year in college, what's happening between Ed and his wife, and this threat and, you know, the consequences of it. What if it actually is true, if what's been told to you in this dream, and how do you choose to deal with that information, or actually to really deal with your past? And Ed and his wife, Jo, have very kind of different philosophies about how to proceed with life when you can't get questions answered. Or do you let the past, you know, overwhelm you and destroy your present? Or do you look at what you have and keep moving forward?
Sounds like Edward King could be a very therapeutic work for a lot of us. It's Central Works at Berkeley City Club through June 11th. The Berkeley City Club is at 2315 Durant Avenue in Berkeley. John Patrick Moore as Edward King, and writer Gary Graves, thanks for coming in today. We look forward to catching the show.
Thanks
so much.
I think
we have a little promo, yeah?
Oh, please.
Sorry.
Oh, you want?
That's right. Well, Thursday nights is always pay what you can at Central Works, but this weekend it's 2-for-1 if you just mention KALW.
Oh, very sweet. Mention KALW for the 2-for-1, and you can also go learn more about the production at centralworks.org. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
That's music from Beach House, which you'll hear as part of the production of The Mushroom Cure at the Marsh. Bringing Adam Strauss's off-Broadway hit to San Francisco for its West Coast premiere now through the 3rd of June. It was inspired by a scientific study showing that hallucinogenic mushrooms may cure obsessive-compulsive disorder, or OCD. Strauss then embarked on a program of vigilante psychopharmacology of his own design. Adam is a writer and performer based in New York. He won the Lef Craft Your Character Storytelling Competition and the New York Fringe Festival's Overall Excellence Award for Solo Performance. Also a stand-up comedian who performs throughout the U.S. and the U.K. He received his B.A. in psychology from Brown University. And Adam Strauss joins me in studio to talk about the show. Welcome, Adam.
Yeah, thank you for having me, David.
Well, boy, what a long, strange trip it's been for you, I guess is the way we could start. Well, first of all, the show running in the Edinburgh Fringe Festival to great reviews, then off-Broadway, and now on the off-center island of misfit toys, as I like to call San Francisco.
I like that. I have not heard that before. I'm going to use that.
Please. Welcome. Have you been here before?
I was here 8 or 9 years ago, just for a week or two. But this is the first time. Well, I did a little stand up then, but this is the first time I've been in the city for any length of time and done any sort of theater run here.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's been a great experience so far. I mean, the weather has been spectacular since I arrived, which I understand is not.
Oh, it's like this all the time. We get these like 3 day periods of beautiful weather like this, and then like ice cold winds coming in from the west by 1 p.m. It's like, this is supposed to be summer,
right?
So this is a very personal story for you, and you managed to look at what is a very serious condition for you, OCD, with humor. Were you always able to handle this that way?
Well, I think humor is one of my coping mechanisms, both for myself and how I relate to the world and other people. So I think there always was an element of humor, because OCD is... it can be a horrific condition, and it certainly was for me, and still occasionally is. But there is something kind of ridiculous about it. The repetitive behaviors, the magical thinking. There is something, I think, comedic about it. And I think, you know, the underside of most tragedy, maybe all tragedy, if you look hard enough, I think you can find some comedy. So, I mean, it was, as you said, it's a personal story. It's a completely true story. I don't even change the names of other people on the show. So I don't use last names.
Okay,
but
Well, when did the first telltale signs of OCD present in your case?
Well, I'd always had a fairly florid history of, I guess I would say, anxiety as a broad term. You know, trying to control my environment, panic, stuff like that from a quite early age.
And where were you raised?
I was raised in suburban Boston. You know, comfortable, happy family upbringing, but the anxiety was very strong from a very early age.
Other siblings?
Yeah. I'm the oldest.
I don't want to be your shrink here.
Right, yeah, I'm happy. I'm an open book, so. I was the oldest of three. Very close family, still very close to everyone.
Nice.
There was this, I mean, the story, the family lore is when I was born, the maternity nurse told my mother that I did something that nurse had never seen before, which was when the nurse leaned in to put in, I guess, their antibiotic eye drops, I reached up and swatted her hand away.
And then you organized all the babies according to size.
Right, right. You're not doing this right. There's a more efficient way to administer these eye drops. Let me show you how to do your job. But the OCD, to answer your question, the anxiety didn't fill that OCD mold, which I would define the signature of OCD as some sort of repetitive or ritualized behavior. It didn't assume that form until I had a particularly meaningful romantic relationship end. And I didn't realize the correlation until I started telling this story on stage. In hindsight, it was very apparent. It was within a few weeks after this relationship ended that I started developing these OCD symptoms. I didn't know that's what it was. It spiraled out of control very quickly to the point that I was spending, you know, a good day, it might just be hours on the OCD. Bad days, well, it wasn't just bad days. There would be bad weeks where I would barely leave my apartment, barely function.
Mm.
And that was, what, you know,
that was a solid 8 years of my life where it really took over like that. And I'd been on all sorts of medications.
I was going to ask, what did you go through before?
I had been on Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, Xanax, Effexor, Lamictal, Lexapro. I'd seen all sorts of specialists, yoga, meditation, hypnotism, acupuncture.
Wow.
And nothing had helped, which unfortunately is not that unusual. The best data is about half of people with OCD don't respond well to any conventional treatment. And I certainly fell into that category. And so then I read this scientific study where they found – it was a small pilot study, but pretty remarkable results of giving psilocybin, the main psychoactive compound in hallucinogenic mushrooms, to people with treatment-resistant OCD. And they all had a significant remission, some for a relatively short period of time. But one subject out of the nine, 6 months later, he was still symptom-free. So, you know, of course, in the study, the researchers cautioned, you know, this is a pilot study. Basically, you know, a lot more research is needed. But I was desperate. So
where did you read about the study?
I read about that. I was living in New York at the time. Uh-huh. And actually, it was at a particular time when I was holed up in my apartment, as I so often was at that point, in an OCD ritual. And so I read that, and my thought was, well, what do I have to lose?
And you struck out on your own rather than...
and I struck out on my own. Uh-huh. And that really is the jumping-off point for the show The Mushroom Cure, is when I read that study and resolve to try, as you said, this program of vigilante psychopharmacology.
So tell us about your director, Jonathan Libman, and his contributions to reining you in your show, shall we say. Is that the right way to get it?
Well... In some dimensions, yes, reining me in. I mean, well, so I had never. You referred to me when you were introducing me earlier on the show as an actor. The truth is, I'm not an actor. I've never acted in anything. One person saw me do stand up and cast me in their movie years ago, and it was an almost fatal mistake for them for their movie. I'm good at playing myself, but. Really what happened is I had these experiences, and as I was undergoing them, there was a real sense that I might not survive this. But there was also a sense that, wow, if I do make it out the other end, this is going to make an amazing story. And I was already doing stand-up at that point.
So you're acting in that way.
Yes.
You're doing stand-up, you're acting. Yeah, I'm going to give you some acting cred.
I get into these discussions with my director, too. I certainly had some performance experience, and I wanted to. I felt like the story itself, independent of my ability to tell it well or poorly, the actual facts as they occurred, and my perception of those facts is pretty remarkable, the way things unfolded. So as things started to get better, after I kind of went through the eye of the needle, as it were, or the hurricane, whatever metaphor you want to use, and came out the other end, I started talking about this on stage in a stand-up context, and I realized that wasn't the right setting, just because there's a lot of narrative here, a lot of things happened. And stand up, you know, there's a certain.
It's got to be hit after hit.
Exactly. Kind of, yeah. Exactly. So.
They're saying, hey, well, the stage.
Right.
So all you need is a heckler if you're going through this condition. Right.
Exactly. So I started. So I applied and did the Edinburgh Fringe. And that was the first time I'd really told the story. It wasn't even a theater. It was the back room of a pub. It's Edinburgh. But it was a great experience, and realized that it really connected deeply with at least some people. But I am a perfectionist, and I got out of Edinburgh, and I said, you know, the show could be better. So for the next year or so, I would just go on stage. There was never any script at this point. I was just telling the story. I'd go on stage with a different outline once a week and just tell the story. Sometimes it came out – sometimes I think it was an engaging performance. So, one notable occasion, I think two-thirds of the audience walked out because I was just – rambling. I didn't know what I was talking about. Or more precisely, I knew what I wanted to talk about, but I didn't. It's very hard to come up with a structured story on the fly, I learned. And then I decided to do the New York Fringe Festival. And going into that, I realized I have 25 different versions of the story floating around. I need an outside set of eyes and ears to take a look at what I'm doing and help me sort of, as you said, rein things in. And that's when I started working with Jonathan. And he's been tremendously influential, not just in a traditional directorial perspective. He certainly has helped me further develop the piece. He's helped me shape it. He's helped me figure out how to act it more effectively. So yeah, we've it's been a really rewarding creative process working with him on this.
Obviously, can't be performed under the influence of mushrooms.
Well,
I imagine. Well, in that case, are there?
I will say, audience members have more than once offered me, and in fact, someone offered me last night's performance, asked me if I wanted a mushroom chocolate before I went on stage. And I had to decline.
I would say, because I mentioned you've learned that not all trips are necessarily good trips.
Yes, it was not a smooth journey, as I recount in The Mushroom Cure, by any means. There were some very challenging experiences.
Mm-hmm. And the music you've chosen is from Beach House. How did you hear about them? What do you like about them?
You know, a woman who plays a major role in the show, this woman, Grace, introduced me to them. And there's really no music in the show, but this is sort of our pre- and post-show music. And I guess I like it because it's a great question. No one's ever asked me this before. But there's something psychedelic and dreamy about it, but there's ultimately, I feel like, a real element of hope. Hmm. And I think that's what – the show is very dark at times. I really don't hold back. I show my condition in all of its, you know – squalor and ugliness. Mm-hmm. But I think there is something redemptive in sharing that experience for me and the audience. And I think Beach House, in a nice way, they sort of capture that.
Nice. Well, I guess proving that laughter also can be the best medicine, perhaps combined with some hallucinogens.
Right.
Adam Strauss is in The Mushroom Cure, his own work, at the Marsh through June 3rd, Wednesdays and Fridays at 8:30 on Saturdays. For more information, go to themarsh.org. Here's some more music from Beach House and Home Again. Thanks for coming in, Adam.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Of course. The Oakland Symphony continues its long-standing commitment to exploring important works of musical theater and closes its 2016-17 season with a concert version of the 1950 Tony Award-winning Guys and Dolls with music by Frank Lesser. I'm pleased to be joined by Maestro Michael Morgan, the leader of the Oakland Symphony, to talk about tomorrow night's concert and to give us a little preview of next season's Oakland Symphony. Hey, Michael, welcome back.
Always nice to be here.
Indeed. Well, Frank Lesser's Guys and Dolls, what a classic piece of Americana that we have here. A 1955 film version with Frank Sinatra and a memorable performance by Marlon Brando. Several Broadway revivals, including a 2015 revival as part of the Chichester Festival and subsequent West End production. What was your connection with Guys and Dolls? When did you first get entranced by it?
Well, I've always thought it was a great show. And this American Masterworks series that we do, every couple of years we do a major musical in concert, it's actually difficult to land on shows that you think are both musically substantial enough, important sort of in the history of musical theater, and where the orchestra has enough to do, because it is, after all, an Oakland Symphony concert. So I always thought Guys and Dolls was a great show, and then when I programmed it, I found out that everybody else thinks it's a great show. The response from audience and from just sort of random people, when I announced it last year that we were doing it, just a gasp from the audience, because everyone likes this show. And it is really extraordinary music with a really good book and really clever lyrics. So I'm looking forward to the whole thing.
How did you come across your cast of characters for this?
Well, some of them are sort of our Oakland Symphony family. Ben Jones has been with us before. It was in Follies and other things that we've done.
He'll be your Sky Masterson.
And he's Sky Masterson. Annie Sherman is new to us, was recommended by my associate conductor, Brian Neese, who is really the master of all things musical theater. And Jack Wilkins, also new to me. But Tammy Deborah, who is doing the Adelaide, which is really
a critical role
in that piece, she's been with us for several things. She was the old woman in Candide. She was in Follies with us. She's been in a lot of things and is a really fantastic performer. Currently on the road in the national tour of Kinky Boots in that company, so she's coming off of that to be with us for a couple of days.
You mentioned Jack Wilkins. He'll be your Nathan Detroit. And Annie Sherman is Sarah Brown. Sister Sarah.
Joy Myers, who's been with us for several shows, is our Nicely Nicely.
Nice that you're having Joe Wicht as part of the cast, too.
Yeah, Joe Wicht is also new. He's going to do Arvid, which is the older guy role. And I'm just getting to know him. We did a crossover cabaret show last week as our preview event for this. It was a takeoff on the Miscast gala that the MCC Theater does in New York every year, where basically big Broadway people, everybody from Broadway, comes in and they do their favorite songs, but all songs they could never do in the shows because they're either the wrong gender or generally the wrong gender or the wrong age or they couldn't be cast. And that's why it's called Miscast. And we called our version Crossover Cabaret. And we had a whole bunch of artists of various ages, all the boys doing girl songs, all the girls doing boy songs. We even had a Suddenly Seymour where the two singers reversed the roles of male and female in that duet. It was such fun. We're going to do it again. It was just great.
Should mention that Joe Wick's alter ego is Trauma Flintstone. So he does a
yes,
crossover
that's
to say
right.
the least.
He does. He is the king. Would you say king of queen
see.
Of crossover? He's some sort of royalty in the crossover world.
Indeed. So in addition to the wonderful music of Frank Lesser and Guys and Dolls, Overture to Gypsy is going to be part of the program, music by Julie Stein. Again, Brian Neese conducting that, as well as he'll start things off with the Oklahoma Overture and the Carousel Waltz of Richard Rodgers.
That's right. That's just to show off the rest of the orchestra, because the Guys and Dolls is actually just a little part of the orchestra.
Mm-hmm. And so that concert is tomorrow evening, Friday at 8:00 at the Paramount Theater. Information about the concert and more about the Oakland Symphony at oaklandsymphony.org. Which brings us to the recent announcement of the 2017-18 season. How is it possible we got there already? Which gets underway on October 20th with a program called Icons, Iconoclasts, and some music of Beethoven and Shostakovich.
Beethoven 5th, Shostakovich 15th, and we're celebrating my 60th birthday that day.
Oh, fantastic.
It's
nice.
Not that day. My birthday's actually in September, but that's when the
close enough.
Season... Yes,
close
enough.
So a fifth of Beethoven, the 15th of Shostakovich, and maybe a fifth afterwards for celebration.
Or something.
Love and Loss is the theme for the November 17th concert.
Where we do the Rossini Stabat Mater and other pieces.
Dvorak's Stabat Mater was just performed by the Berklee Community Chorus and Orchestra. Actually, will be performed coming up. So nice to get another Stabat Mater
season. We did Dvorak a few years back and are now getting around to the Rossini.
Mm-hmm. And Oakland Symphony Chorus will be the choral element.
That is correct.
Morrow as your director for that. Also in that program, composer I'm not familiar with, Jonah Gallagher.
This is a recent product of our San Francisco Conservatory. And I must say, I've gotten a lot of great new pieces out of the students there. I've taken those pieces to a lot of different orchestras.
Mm-hmm. Your annual Let Us Break Bread Together concert is featured and called Hallelujah this time around, Sunday, December 10th, featuring musical tributes to both Prince and Leonard Cohen.
That's right. As I've been telling people, if you ever had the desire to hear Purple Rain and Sleigh Ride on the same concert, this is your chance.
I hadn't thought about that. I mean, it could be an interesting mix out there. And, the ubiquitous W. Kamau Bell heads your way in January with a playlist to be announced, we should say that we have a great relationship with Kamau here, broadcasting Kamau Bell live at the Norris Theater, among other places.
He is kicking off what I want to be an annual series where we will invite someone from outside the classical music world to just come in and program a concert, and we will play whatever they want on that, within reason, I should say, on that concert. And his concert, it will have everything from some Coltrane to a spiritual to the Fly the Bumblebee. It's all over the road. And that's the idea from the playlist series.
Well, we look forward to hearing what eventually becomes of that playlist. Some LGBTQ is featured in February.
That's our Notes From series, which this year was Notes From Native America. Next year is Notes From LGBTQ America. And that has Sarah Davis Buchner, a great pianist, playing Saint-Saëns on it. Jonathan Blaylock, who is a wonderful tenor, is doing the Britain serenade, tenor horn and strings. And what's really interesting is I'm having a set of songs written that are being orchestrated for singer and orchestra, but it's Noah Galvin, who was the star of The Real O'Neills, the recent ABC show. And the songs really are fantastic, out of fantastic Rosser and Sohn are songwriters out of New York, a fantastic set of songs on what it's like to be sort of out and adolescent. And they're very positive, very universal, but I don't think, to my knowledge, there's not a set of songs on that particular subject actually in the world. And so I'm looking forward to that also.
And Sarah Davis Buchner as piano soloist for?
Yeah, for the Saint-Saëns second piano concerto. Very nice. There's no excuse too small for working with her. I work with her wherever I can.
Terrific, terrific to have her back in the area. Rooted in Oakland is your theme for your March 23rd concert. All composers associated with Oakland? Or
well, no, not all.
Not so much Schubert.
We never do all anything, but a piece will be done by Kev Choice, who is a major rising star in Oakland, in addition to being a great star in, well, I don't know how you describe it, R&B, hip-hop, a little bit of everything. He's another all over the road, but a great performer, and he's writing his first piece for orchestra for us, and that'll be on that concert along with some of our kids from our Muse program. They aren't playing his piece with it's a different piece. But as I say, we don't do all anything at the Oakland Symphony. But yeah, we're doing that concert and calling it Rooted in Oakland.
Nice. And next year is a big Bernstein year, the centennial of Bernstein's birth. You have a personal connection with Lenny, don't you?
Yes, I was a Bernstein student, as so many people were in my generation. I worked with him at Tanglewood and Tanglewood and elsewhere.
Oh, give us a good Tanglewood story, Lenny B.
My favorite Tanglewood story is just it's by standing by the gate one day talking to, I was chatting with Nevin Shalit, who's Gene Shalit's kid, who was working on the gate there back when we were all children. You know, no one's allowed to drive on the grounds. The cars are not allowed there, except Leonard Bernstein drove on with his huge white, I think it was Rolls Royce, you know, convertible, just drove right into the gates because he could.
Leonard Bernstein. So that must have been a memorable summer or summers?
That was a great summer. I was there once as a student. I was back twice as a teacher. So I'm very fond of that place.
Mm-hmm. This season finale for Oakland gets underway Friday. And what is going to be happening with you over the summer? Or are you taking a little time off? What's going on?
No, it never stops completely. I'm doing, I have a June performance with Festival Opera where I'm doing Pagliacci. The other half of that is being conducted by Brian Neese, and it's the Seven Deadly Sins of Kurt Weill. Then we do our usual July 3rd at the Craneway Pavilion in Richmond every year, the Oakland Symphony. It's the most spectacular thing we do. Free concert, great fireworks, in the Craneway Pavilion, which, you know, has a glass side facing the water so you can see the fireworks or you can go outside and watch them, either way. And then we do July 4th at the Alameda County Fair. We do a lot of fireworks. and I go up to my, festival at Bear Valley, at the end of July, beginning of August. That's for 2 weeks. And finally, the Gateways Music Festival, which is held at the Eastman School of Music, but it's not part of the Eastman School. It's in association with, and it's an all African American festival of orchestra music, chamber music, soloists. It's a great family reunion that we have every other year.
Nice. Hopefully, a little bit of downtime this summer before the new Oakland
Symphony. In between things, there's some,
okay, good.
Yeah, there's
good.
Some time off.
And tomorrow night at the Paramount Theater, the season closes of the Oakland Symphony with a concert version of Guys and Dolls, music by Frank Lusser, a book by Joe Swerling and Abe Burrows. OaklandSymphony.org for more information. Maestro, thank you so much for coming down and talking, and we look forward to tomorrow's concert as well as the new season of the Oakland Symphony.
Always a pleasure, and there's even an after party at the Paramount after the concert tomorrow night.
Well, we'll be there. Thanks. Gosh, Fugue for Tin Horns, Adelaide's Lament, If I Were a Bell, Luck Be a Lady Tonight, Sit Down, You're Rocking the Boat. What do we choose from Guys and Dolls to go out with? Well, let's do the Fugue for Tin Horns from Guys and Dolls in concert tomorrow night with the Oakland Symphony.
I got the horse right here, the name is Paul Revere, and here's a guy that says if the weather's clear, can do, can do. This guy says the horse can do, if he says the horse can do, can do, can do.
I'm thinking Valentine, cause on the morning line, the guy has got him figured at 5 to 9. But look at F and half, he weighs it by a half, according to this here is a telegraph.
For Paul Revere out bike, I hear his foot's all right. Of course it all depends if it rained last night.
I know it's Valentine, the morning marks look fine. Besides the jockey's brother's a friend of mine.
And just a minute, boys, I got the Phoenix noise. It's like his great-grandfather with a terrible poise.
I tell you, Paul Revere, now this is no bum steer. It's from a handicap, but that's real sincere.
I go for Valentine, cause on the morning line, the guy has got him figured at 5 to 9.
So make it F and half, he weighs by a half. According to this, here is a telegraph. F and half,
Valentine,
Paul Revere, I got the horse.
Frank Lesser from Guys and Dolls, presented in concert tomorrow night with the Oakland Symphony. Well, I would be remiss if I didn't mention another orchestra playing this weekend that I'm involved in, the Peninsula Symphony. Tomorrow evening at the San Mateo Performing Arts Center, program includes The Planets of Gustav Holst, as well as a concerto for double bass by Bottesini, with William Langley Militch as bass soloist, and Nancy Bloomer Doyson's Transit of Venus. Sam Pack tomorrow evening. Saturday's concert is sold out at the Heritage Theater. Both concerts are at 8 with a pre-concert talk with yours truly, David LaTulipe, at 7. I'll be joined by NASA Bay Area astronomer Andrew Fragnoy, who is a professor at Foothill College. Be a great talk with him, and if you can make tomorrow night, it's at Sam Pack. Information at peninsulasymphony.org.